Civilization, where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.
The invitation came because of the appendix to my latest book, forecast that we are going to enter into a phase that I call the Third World War. I regard that as inevitable. Wayne said that would be a good theme for a discussion down in Brighton, so thank you very much indeed for inviting me, Wayne, and you turning up. This is a grim prognosis that the world is heading for a World War III, and I thought long and hard before I went public with making such a prognosis, because obviously it's extremely serious to be talking in those terms. You're either a crackpot or you must really feel you have a sense of the flow of history, and that flow is leading to another world war. And I'll try and give you a notion of what I mean by the Third World War in a second, but it's incumbent on me to give you very quickly some sense of why I feel that this is the case. I mean, what is the authority for saying it? Anybody can say we're going to have another war, another world war, yeah, but what's the basis? It can't be purely on the grounds of, well, we've had two, so we've got to have a third one, because everything comes in threes. My prognosis is based on a very intensive study of our culture. Our culture is constructed on a set of rules that do not inform political decision making. If there's an alternative model to the capitalist one, the one that's taken as given by those who make the decisions on our behalf, then it's the Marxist model. And although that has taken a battering over the last 20 years, still people can only think as in terms of the socialist, the Marxist critique as the alternative to the capitalist model. Those are the two ways of viewing the world. There is no third alternative. Well, both are wrong. We know capitalism is a dysfunctional system, and it only got away with surviving for so long because the opposition was the Marxist model, which has now had such a battering with the demise of the Soviet Union and then China and Cuba although capitalism is on its uppers, nonetheless, people, the politicians, the apologists for this system can say, well, there is no alternative way of viewing the world. There was, but it's a alternative, let's call it a third way of viewing the world, that is not discussed, is not allowed to inform public debate, because it defines the power structure in a way that goes to the heart of power. It really identifies the pro-social process that puts power, monopoly power, in the hands of a relatively few people, although I'm going to qualify that claim that it's a relatively few people shortly. The power structure is based not on capital, as Marx would have it. If by capital we mean that which we create in order to help us to produce wealth. You know, the factories, the machines, the screwdrivers, the drills. That's man-made capital. And Marx was mainly referring to capital in that sense. But the distortions to our society, the cleavages in our communities, predated the onset of capitalism by 300 years. If we've had capitalism for 200, you know, the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution, when capital became the main, or apparently the main tool for producing wealth, 300 years before that, roughly Henry VIII's time, right at the beginning of the 16th century, our communities were disfigured when the monarchs and their hangers-on, the aristocracy, started to privatize the land, appropriating people's communal rights, displacing people from the land, and taking control over the rental income. And it's that rental income which nobody talks about, that is the rent of the land. This is not the commercial rents we pay when we rent a house or a shop. Yeah, I'm referring to what the economist calls economic rent. And that rent is just for the land, not the buildings and all the improvements on the land. This land rent is what Marx would call the real surplus income. You could argue that the profits that are made from investing in capital equipment and so on is earned. Somebody had to manufacture that capital, it embodies their labour, and they're entitled to a return on it. And that return is not a surplus, it's their due reward for adding value to the wealth of the nation. But no one person created land, or more specifically, the rental value of land. And the rental value of land is traditionally the basis for funding all public expenditure. And in fact, civilization has to be understood in terms of funding the development of culture out of the economic surplus that was produced mainly by agrarian societies that were land-based, which generated a surplus which in our society is paid to the land owner. But it was traditionally that surplus was the basis for funding the development of culture and the onset of civilization. So this stream of surplus rental income is, well, it's sacred income, because our societies would not have evolved into civilizations, complex urban communities, without that surplus revenue, the rents, being invested in the common services, the infrastructure, the arts and crafts that made it possible to develop complex societies. And each civilization would originate where that surplus was pooled to make it possible to develop the culture that made dense living in urban city communities possible in the first place. It was the corruption of that model by the appropriation of those rents for the private benefit of what was initially the few that would begin the deterioration of civilization. It was the beginning of the onset of the decline of civilization. Whoever controlled that surplus controlled society. They controlled even the way people think, because they could not continue to control that surplus without shaping the language that is used to describe the world. So for the last 100 years, for example, it is not an accident that we no longer in economics and in our macroeconomic models have an element in there, an equation that accounts that represents land or the rent of land. This has been faded away from the economic reasoning. So when we have a property boom and a bust, at the end of it, the politicians don't stop and think, well, this was driven by activity in the property market. Yes, some of them do say, well, it was house prices, but then they go on to look for any other excuse to account for a property boom and a bust. And that is a logical consequence of the elites controlling the way we think about the world, so that we don't challenge the basis of their power. That's necessary. It's fundamental that they have to control the laws and the institutions so that they can continue to appropriate the stream of revenue on which we all depend for the vitality of our communities. And in the traumatized society, I summarize briefly the history of the origins of civilizations, and in more detail explain why our civilization is now very definitely on the decline. I believe we are at the turning point where, unless something happens quite quickly, there's no going back. We have to see the end of our civilization, because we can't sustain the system on the basis of the way income is distributed now. So that becomes the basis on which I have to conclude that we are heading for another world war. Why? Well, for the last 500 years, we have seen ordinary people progressively excluded from a share of the rents of land. The rents of land were formerly collected in the form of a land tax. Back in the time of William the Conqueror, the whole of public spending was funded out of the land tax. And that was the case for the following 500 years. But from about Henry VIII's time, the share of public spending drawn from the rents of land declined rapidly, so that by the beginning, early in the 19th century, the share of national income that was devoted to public spending, or rather the proportion of the government revenue that was used to fund public expenses, was down to 4%, and it's even less now. Which means that all that land rent revenue is actually privatized. And that is the basis of the distortions in our societies. The one asset that creates havoc in our social system is what we do with land. And yet, nobody talks about that. On the property TV shows, it's all about bricks and mortar. You've got to invest in bricks and mortar. No discussion about actually bricks and mortar depreciate. It's a wasting asset. It's like you drive a car out of a showroom, it starts to go down in value. And it's the same with a building at a slower rate, but it depreciates. Well, in that case, what's going up in value? It's the location of the house, the land underneath it. And it's not, I'll qualify that in, if I have the time. Today, it's not the aristocracy that controls our society who have access to the rents. It's people like me. It's not the 1% against the 99%, as I have had to tell our friends in the occupied camps outside St. Paul's Cathedral, who are the problem, 1% rich, which is, you know, like the scapegoat in my view. It's the 60% or so, which includes people like me. I am the sort of person that the politicians most fear. Why? Because I own a house, which means I own a plot of land, which means I have an investment in the appreciation of a little piece of land that goes up and up and up in value. But no one talks about the land going up in value. It's, oh, houses, the bricks and mortar. Martin Wolf, who is the chief economics commentator for the Financial Times, did an article back in 2010 when he reviewed an earlier book of mine. And he said, in 1984, he bought a house and he estimated that the value of the land underneath the house was worth £100,000. In 2010, it was then worth £1 million. So from £100,000 to £1 million, just for that little residential plot of land. But nobody talks in those terms, but that's where the value is. And that means that governments will not alter the structure of policy, public policy, because of the fear, not of the landowning aristocracy, which is what used to be the case up to about 100 years ago. Now it's the middle class homeowner who has the whip hand, mainly people who are close to or in retirement age. We own most of the residential property in Britain, and the young people are excluded because the prices have gone up so high, and we're not going to reduce the prices to allow people to afford homes. And so we have a political system that is gridlocked in terms of public policy. It can't break out of the present rut, which is antisocial, for fear of the politicians losing the votes of the people who are the ones who vote, who are, in the main, the well-heeled, middle class, hard working homeowner, beloved of the Daily Express and the Daily Mail. We've democratized a barbarous system because ordinary folk like me are being co-opted into it. And I don't want this system changed because it might mean that I will lose some of the value in my house. That's a false statement, actually, because if you rebalance the tax regime, I'd be better off because we have a pernicious fiscal system at the moment. The plan, the game plan over the previous 300, 400 years, going back to Henry, was let's reduce the land tax, because it was a handful of families who owned most of Britain at the time, the aristocracy, and they controlled parliament and tax policy, so their objective was to reduce the land tax, which meant that then to pay for the walls and the rest of it, they had to put a tax on beer, on salt, on anything other than the land. So we had a tilting of tax policy, transferring the costs of public funding onto working people and away from the land, right? That has got to be reversed, and the politicians today will not reverse this destructive, pernicious tax regime because they fear that the homeowner will not vote for them. So I want to stress that the enemy within is, I represent that group of people because I'm a homeowner and I don't want government to do the rational thing, even though actually I'd be financially better off after the transition, that is, if taxes were rebalanced. And I ought to add, okay, so this is a distinctive way of viewing the world, but what is that? How does that give me the authority to make forecasts about the future, particularly dire ones like, oh, we're going to enter a world war? Well, it's understanding the role of land in our society that opens up a perception of the grand trends that go into the future with clarity that is not available to politicians. And so let me give you very quickly an example of the way I can look into the future and correctly anticipate trends which all the statisticians in Whitehall, with all the think tanks at their disposal like the Institute of Fiscal Studies, with the support of the IMF and the World Bank and the OECD can't. In 1983 I published a book saying, look, the next crash will be 1992, based on understanding the price trends in the land. So 1992 comes along and sure, economic crisis. In 1997, Gordon Brown becomes the Chancellor, Tony Blair's the new Prime Minister. I wrote to all of them. Alistair Darling, Blair, the spin doctor with whom I used to work, Alistair Campbell, with whom I worked in Fleet Street. I wrote to five of them in the Treasury and in Downing Street. And I said, oh, you've got 10 years, house prices will peak in 2007, then we will have a depression. They did nothing, of course. House prices peaked in the last quarter of 2007, and you all know what has happened in the last 4 to 5 years. And I know when the next crash is going to be, major housing crash. It's all actually written into the history books. If you know what to look for, the patterns are so regular, you don't have to be an Einstein to see those trends. So I could write to this coalition government, in fact I had to Vince Cable, who just happens to be my constituency MP, explaining the trends, what's going to happen. Vince Cable actually agrees with me, but he can't say so because he's in the government. But this doesn't require a special expertise on my part, just an understanding of how things actually work within this kind of an economy. So I know that the next major downturn, the crash, will be in 2028. chances are I won't be here then, but some of you are young, most of you are young enough so that you'll be able to think back to this year, right, in this Quaker friend's house and say, golly, Harrison was right, when in 2028 the world will be in a probably a worse state than it is today. I don't have a crystal ball, there's no magic involved, it's understanding the dynamics of the existing economy and reading the empirical evidence in the history books to know that I'm absolutely right. So, based on a track record that suggests that I can see into the future with some element of precision, I feel confident that I can say that as things stand today, there is no way of escaping the onset of the convergence of a lot of violent events which, when we come to look back on them, will be classed as a world war. Why? We are not a value-adding, a value-producing economy anymore. The politicians moan about we need more manufacturing, and you know, 10 or 20% of the economy is based on production, sure, but it's a tiny proportion and it's getting smaller. And even the nations that are committed to being the industrial powerhouse of the global economy, like China, is also rapidly taking on the characteristics of what I call the predator culture. I saw it at close quarters in Russia from 1991 onwards. I spent a lot of time in Russia saying, land is in public ownership here. All you need to do is take the taxes off working people, use the rents to fund public expenses, and you will have the freest, most dynamic, fairest economy in the world. But of course, they wouldn't. The IMF wouldn't allow that, nor would Brussels or Washington. They sent in their consultants and their lackeys who drafted the property rights and the laws on taxation. And so Russia went down the pan. Most of the natural resources, meaning rents, right? When you hear the word oligarch, think automatically the resource rents from oil, bauxite, gas, gold, diamonds. All these generate rents. They're going into the pockets of a, you know, 20 or 30 families. And those rents, instead of being invested in Russia in the educational system, the welfare of the people, enhancing the culture, where are they ending up? In Knightsbridge real estate, in Chelsea football clubs, huge yachts in the south of France. So the lifeblood, in the form of the rents of Russia's natural resources, is leaving the country, exhausting the population, a death rate that is shocking. They are losing middle-aged people at a horrifying rate in Russia. The will to live is ebbing away. And that lifeblood is ending up in Chelsea Football Club, etc. So it's happened in Russia and it's happening now in China, where, yes, they still produce a lot of fabulous goods that they then ship to the West, but the people there are now more interested in becoming second and third homeowners in Peking, Beijing. They're building up property portfolios, and they want to invest off plan in apartments in England and in San Francisco, rather than creating capital investments in enterprises in Russia, sorry, in China, to raise the level of wages of the people, which are still extremely low, rebuilding China after the 40, 50 years of communist legacy. No, they would rather all that surplus be sucked out of China and invested in the way I described. Now, if China is also turning to be a predator economy and is preparing to fight over natural resources in the South China Sea, if the West is worried about who is going to control the minerals underneath the melting ice cap in the Arctic, and they're jockeying for control over that influence, if Europe is going to continue to implode, there is no way we can get out of this downward spiral that we're in. There is nothing to turn things around in Europe. If America is going to continue to lose its influence, as it is doing and as it will, as it must continue to do, because its scope for controlling world events will hemorrhage away as well, as the Middle Eastern countries under the influence of Islam starts to fragment the willingness of people to remain silent has been smashed, as we've seen in Egypt and the other Arab countries. When you put all of those things together, when you realize that China, just through controlling the huge cash surpluses that it has, could crush the American economy just by flooding the world markets with its surplus dollars in a currency war. This is to say nothing about the scope for individual geeks with their cyberspace techniques causing havoc in the Pentagon just by sitting at their home computers. When you put all that together, where is the influence that says we can overcome the fragmentation, the tensions, the disputes, the inequalities, the desperation that is boiling up throughout the world? What would lead us to conclude that there is any constructive fraternal power or design or thrust that can overcome the converging tensions in our social system? Even the CIA says that if the existing trends in poverty, the environment, the economy, if just two of those trends collide in some way, for instance, if the demographic crisis impinges on the economy, if there are too many old folk, not enough young, productive people, then there is a collision between the demographic crisis and the underperforming economy. What the CIA says is that what you get then is a megatrend, and the megatrend, which results from the convergence of just two of the global negative trends that are around now, creates a disaster greater than the sum of the parts. That's what they mean by a mega trend. Now, if the CIAs are foreseeing this and are saying, look, if things get out of hand in the Middle East, there's a lot of people that are frustrated, they want jobs, they want rising living standards, they're not getting them, they are told by their mullahs that actually if they strap bombs onto themselves, then they can change their destiny. If you have that, and you have a frustrated American empire not able to control events, Europe then becomes aggressive because it's fragmenting, which it is, you will have the convergence not just of two events to create one megatrend, but two or three megatrends. The environment will collide with economics. You can build your own scenarios to show that the world really is out of control. The politicians do not know what to do about it, and it's just one big disaster. A third world war? No, it won't be like the standards First or Second World War, where one or two countries declare war against each other and they conscript their workers and say, okay guys, go into those trenches and get yourself killed, and we'll exhaust ourselves, and then peace will come. My fear, my strong sense is that it will be a world at war with itself, a convergence of many local, regional conflicts of the kind which will butt up against each other, feed off each other. So we will end up with wars at the levels, not just of military conflict, but economic wars, protectionism. Europe is going to have to do something within the next 2 or 3 or 4 years to protect jobs, because it is becoming almost totally unmanageable at the present time, as the politicians are beginning to acknowledge. When the Americans realize that they've lost their absolute influence over the world, when the Chinese start asserting their influence over Japan, which they've already begun to with nurturing the nationalist animosity against Japan, what we end up with is not a world war, but a world at war with itself, the people. It just becomes the world consuming itself. It's the predators, people like me, who want to hang on to our capital gains, who are going to resist the changes which would actually resolve these problems very quickly. And one of the reasons why I have a pessimistic outlook is that in the book, The Traumatized Society, I show that historically, where individual countries have come to the point where they're going to have a revolution, people, I won't say like me, because that casts me in a certain role, but eminent people within those societies went to the decision makers, which happened to be the kings, to say, unless you change the tax regime, unless you start drawing the revenue from the rents of land and allow people the economic freedoms that would come automatically with that redesigned economy, you're going to have a revolution. Well, Turgot told the king in France before the French Revolution, but he was the Minister of Finance, but the king said, sod off, we're not doing this. He was displaced from his job, and they had a French Revolution. He lost his head. Tolstoy warned the Tsar in Russia, unless you make this one change, we can see there's the threat of a revolution in Russia, and the Tsar Nicholas said, no, we're not doing that. He and his family were shot in a basement. If you go to China, there was a man called Sun Yat-sen who made it abundantly clear to the last of what turned out to be the last of the dynasties. What we need is a change in the pattern of property rights and the tax system. Modeled on what I'm telling you about, the need to realign taxes so that the revenue was drawn from the rents of land, and we untaxed people who went to work. But the last of the dynasties said, sod off, no, we're not doing that. And they had a Chinese revolution. Sun Yat-sen, as it turns out, became the first president of the new republic. But he couldn't institute this reform because Mao was running his guerrilla campaign against the Republicans, and that civil war continued till what turned out to be the Second World War, where Sun Yat-sen's political party, the Kuomintang, was ultimately defeated by Mao. The Kuomintang fled to Formosa, and the communists took over the control of China. Which is a neat way of me being able to say that what happened in Formosa ought to be of interest to development economists, because once Sun Yat-sen's ragtag army got onto Formosa, they called it Taiwan, they instituted land reform, they pensioned off the landowners, they realigned the tax regime, and lo and behold, what did we have? The first Asian tiger. Boom, the economy went. And still they are a force to be reckoned with. Just a scrappy island off the mainland China, and the one secret that they had that released the energies of ordinary folk was to realign the tax regime by getting rid of the landlords, pensioning them off literally, and introducing a land tax, and bingo. So we see in history that wisdom does not prevail. So here I am saying we're going to have another world war, but nobody's taking any notice, and why should they? Because the political elites represent the powerful economic interests, which are the landowners to start with, which I've acknowledged now includes people like me, the bankers, most of whose profits actually do come from the rent of land through the mortgages. So they don't have the bother of dealing with land, they just suck some of the rents out of the system through their financial power. And the others who cream off some of those rents. If you want a contemporary alternative presentation of what I'm saying in the economic sphere, go to Joseph Stiglitz's book, published last year, called The Price of Inequality. And there you will see, he says, that the big problem really is this rent-seeking activity that distorts, disfigures our economy, disfigures politics, gives all the power to the lobbyists who represent the people who have the financial clout to buy legislation. You'll find it in Joseph Stiglitz's book, but nobody's taken any notice of Stiglitz. He's a Nobel Prize-winning economist. He's a professor at Columbia. But he's a renegade because he's saying something that's taboo, as I am. Well, when you stitch all this together, you end up concluding that actually the formulas that worked in the past can't work now because there's nowhere to turn. What happened over the previous, up until the end of the 19th century, what happened over the previous 400 years was that as people were displaced out of their village communities, and England is the paradigm for this, it's the metaphor for the whole of what happened in Europe. As people were displaced out of their communities, they became vagabonds, they had to turn to thieving to survive, thousands upon thousands were hung, but the kings could maintain some kind of stability by doing two things. One, have a war, which kills off a lot of people, very convenient. And the other is, go and steal a lot of land on other continents, which means the elites here sucked in the rents from those territories, but also provided the space to get rid of the people we didn't want. So our society was a barbarous one in that we had to get rid of English people. They were surplus to requirements. You can see this in crystal clear terms with the Irish case, which only stopped exporting its main product, which was young people, about 20 years ago. It's now resumed. They thought they were the Celtic tiger. They thought that finally they could reverse the trend of emigration out of Ireland. And so Irish people started going back to Ireland. The Celtic tiger was a spurious thing, pathetic creature. And if you go around the ghost towns scattered around Ireland, you will see why it's a pathetic, a hollow dream that could never work. They were speculating, they're building houses that nobody wanted, offering them at prices that were for silly money, just in order to extract the rents of the land. Now there are hundreds of estates scattered across the land that are empty. Buildings going derelict. They're supposed to have a housing crisis. And yet all these houses are derelict and many of them will have to be demolished. And it's the same in Spain and Portugal and also in the United States. They were using the property market to extract the rents of land. But to come back to the history, in the past we were able to solve temporarily, sporadically, the social tensions because we could kill off a lot of the population by having wars or export them onto other people's territory. We would grab the land off the indigenous communities in North America, South America, Australia, ultimately Africa in the late 19th and early 20th century. And so we could get rid of people, that relieved the stress. Today, we don't have that option because, yes, We are seeing a rerun of it. So a lot of young Portuguese guys are now going to Angola, one of the former provinces, colonies, looking for work. The same with Italians and Spaniards, and some of them are coming over here. Some of our people are trying to find work in Australia, but this is at a pathetically low level. The scope for employment in other territories has gone because they are also locked into a depression. So the relief mechanisms that used to work from the 18th, 19th, and then early into the 20th century, which was grab the rents from other territories, that makes up the deficit here, and get rid of the people that are surplus to requirements, shove them onto the virgin lands that we've nicked off the tribal peoples of other continents, is a model that doesn't work. So how are we going to solve the problem of the debt now, when we can't steal the rents from other continents? And how are we going to relieve the pressure from unemployed people when we can't send them on boats to other continents because they're not needed on those other continents? What are we going to do? It's like a kettle that's the pressure's building up, and at some point something's got to give. It's got to explode. But it's not just Europe. It's also in North America. It's also in the Middle East. China is locked into this cycle, the business cycle, already, right from the word go. So when you put all those things together, there is no way to rebase the economic system on constructive principles that enable people to start building out of the cul-de-sac that we're in. There isn't anything. The politicians are relying on something happening spontaneously. But why should it? At the end of the day, we had a depression in the 1870s, and I've tracked how from the 1870s the logical escape route was World War I. And then from the 1920s and through the 1930s, there was no escape route except let's have a bloody good war. Kill millions. It takes 10 years of rationing, but okay, we finally start to rebuild the capital base and we get back to full employment. But who are we going to have a world war with now? What's the alternative? Well, there is an alternative. It's the one that Turgot was recommending to Louis back in the 1780s, before the revolution. There's the same solution that Tolstoy was recommending to the Tsar in Russia in the late 1890s, before the onset of their revolution. It's the same mechanism that would have solved the Chinese problem and forestalled the communist revolution, which the last of the dynasties refused to listen to. That model is the only model that would enable us to control the system to start restoring a balance. You just shift the fiscal burden off working people and onto the rents generated by, or rather through, the land market, and that would immediately have an electrifying effect. You start with reducing the income tax. A lot of people who can't be employed today would become employable. A lot of people are unemployable at the moment because their productivity is low. And if the employer didn't have to pay a tax on top of the wage, those people would be employable. It's only because the government comes along and says, oh, well, look, we're going to put a tax on top of the wage, that the employer says, look, these people, a large swathe of low productivity people, we can't afford to employ them because their productivity doesn't warrant both a living wage and the tax on top of that. Remove the tax and those people are employable. They now are paying their way. And that includes them paying rents for the shelter that they need. And if those rents were divided between the rent that goes into the building, which is payable to the owner of the building, and the other part of the rent that goes to the state, because it's a value that is captured through the land market, but it's a value created by all of us. If that went to the state, then the lowest income people would be paying their way through the shelter that that they were funding out of their wages. So that's just the lowest productivity end. But if you progressively remove the tax burden off all working people, and you removed it off the cost of purchasing goods, so that the price of goods starts to come down, which makes those goods exportable into the world markets to people who otherwise can't afford them, you automatically start to re-energize the economy. And you do not sacrifice public services at all, because you are you're drawing the rents from the land simultaneously to keep the public services funded. But the public services costs start to come down, because now we're having to lay out less in the way of unemployment benefits. Fewer people are depressed, so there's less going into health. And now the money that we do draw can go constructively into creating a decent educational system, funding the arts, and all the things that makes a civilized society worth living in. We could do that. In other words, my message is not utterly depressing and destructive one. It's one of hope, other than that, as I've already told you, the people with power will not listen. They won't do it. The only way we're going to get the change is if enough people turn out into the streets, as they've done in Cairo and all the other capitals in the Middle East. Just sit in the square and say, okay, we're not moving until you come to terms with, what is it, a linguistic shift. Let's talk about land and rent. And let's talk about the possibility of getting rid of taxes that destroy jobs. That's all we want. This is not a violent upheaval of a revolution. There's no bloodletting involved in this. People like me would come along and say, but I earned my house and I want to leave my house to my children. Well, all right, but look, we're going to implement this change over, let's say, 10 years. It's a control change. We can't have shock therapy. But the markets would adapt very rapidly once it was convinced that this was going to happen. And so good things would be happening. So, the land value under my house would go down proportionately as the revenue was being taken for public purposes. But my other assets would start to rise in value. So I'd be pumping my savings not into buying real estate, a second house and a third house and so on. No, I'd now be investing in the productive enterprises that create jobs. And so the rate of return on my pension is not prejudiced at all. It's just now coming from the value-adding activities rather than this destructive one of me owning a house, sitting back and waiting for it to go up in value, and then cashing in towards the end of my life, going and buying a yacht in the West Country and living the life of Riley, and leaving young kids today suffering because they can't get married, because they can't get a decent shelter to start a family. So we live in a cannibalistic society, and the only way we're going to shift the attitudes of those who make the decisions is by enough people. In other words, a democratic uprising, an uprising that's utterly peaceful, that just says enough's enough. For those of you who think that this is not possible, in 1909, the Liberal Party, which was in power at the time, did say this is exactly what we will be doing. And the finance bill, which became an Act of Parliament in 1909, called the People's Budget, did institute the beginnings of this. And this was on the basis of a democratic mandate. From 1905, the people of Britain, through their council, local councils, and in their street meetings and so on, they said, we've got to change things. It didn't happen because the landlords still had the power to fight the rearguard action. They demonstrated that we do not have a democracy in this country, because although this was instituted in the 1909 Finance Act, it was not allowed to be implemented, and it wasn't. And then along comes the World War, and so that got abandoned. happened again in 1931. The Chancellor of the Exchequer, Lord Philip Snowden at the time, introduced into Parliament an act that would have done exactly what I'm telling you, but the Conservatives wouldn't allow it to be implemented. So, as I say, we do not live in a democracy at all. Not when it comes to this one issue. Okay, just realise that this Parliament, this democracy of ours, this rule of law that we try to sell to everybody else in the rest of the world, will allow us to do anything we like. We can pass any law under the sun, except the one that affects the rent of land. And that's what you've got to get your head around. So there is a way of solving our problems, but in the meantime, I've been, for the purpose of making a YouTube film about the Euro crisis, I've been travelling around Europe. I've been to Portugal and Spain and Sardinia and Italy, Greece. Young people are killing themselves from the early 20s age. Never mind about going into depression. Suicide rates are up. Huge numbers are trying to leave their country because there's just no hope for them. The doctors that I interviewed have confirmed that they've done their analyses to demonstrate that the heart attacks that used to be the privilege of people my age are now being endured by people in their early 20s through the stress of the kind of lives that they've got. So what we have is a continent in utter despair. And the politicians do not have a clue as to what to do. They don't even talk about how we got here. They don't. They know there was something to do with subprime mortgages or something to do with house prices, but oh, it's the bankers really, isn't it? The greedy bankers. And we're not going to do anything about them anyway. We'll have some regulation, but we mustn't scare away the bankers, must we? So we live in a pathetic world, and it's all because the people with the real power, which is power over the taxable, the real taxable income of our communities, which is the rents of land and natural resources, is being clung to with absolute monopoly power, such that we don't even talk about it. So, folks, I think I should just put a halt to it there, and we've got a little under half an hour for you to offer your views, certainly ask your questions, and see where it takes us.
Thank you very much.
So, any questions?
Yes, I think, thanks very much. I agree with everything you said, pretty much. I have a very positive outlook, very optimistic outlook, because, and I haven't actually seen this point of view of land and taxes as a solution. Of course, as you say, the real problem is the story that we all hold in our minds about money and commerce and law and even our own identity.
Yeah.
Because when we learn our own identity and our own authority, we can find some kind of freedom with it. But so, the thing that I've been interested in, which you haven't really mentioned,
yeah,
which I'd like to get some comment on, is money and what that is, mm-hmm, and how money is created and issued, and because basically we live in a slavery system, my perception, a slavery system, which is fueled by private money for public use, which we borrow at interest, and all our taxes go to pay that. So that's, you know, the taxes are going straight into the pockets of this global mafia. And if we were just aware of that and just said, okay, let's default on our debts. Because it's all a fiction. It's just a fiction. And I'd just like some comment on that.
Yes, sure. There's a very powerful stream of reformist people who focus on the money issue and basically the critics of the monetary system, and their criticisms are absolutely correct, okay? I'm saying that. They are absolutely correct in their critique of the fraud that's perpetrated by the financial system. They are as convinced that that is the major problem as I am when I focus on land and rent. So how do I resolve that? And I do it this way. The money fraud, which I concede it is, that banks just create credit out of thin air and they then demand to be rewarded for their generosity in agreeing to put an entry in their ledger saying they've lent you 50,000, 100,000, whatever it is, and then they want you to pay them 5 or whatever percent it is. That's a, you know, a cruel hoax. It came after the land story began. If we look at the UK case, starting with Henry VIII, land became privatised. The money lenders, or the merchants in the City of London, could see that there was money to be made assisting the aristocracy in buying and selling land. So the merchants, who were not bankers, they were merchants, but who had spare cash, agreed to use, they got together, some of them, and pulled their cash and helped to fund the embryonic land market. So now we had this, the emergence of a modern, the modern land market, the buying and selling of land. And the money lenders from the coffee houses in the back streets of the City of London found that, lo and behold, they could make a handsome profit by lending the money which they had earned as merchants to people in the land market. Then, subsequently, the Bank of England is created. I forgot the date, it's the late 17th century, whenever it was. And from then on, the bankers found that they could systematize through the power that they were allowed to have by a corrupt aristocracy in Parliament, they could extract part of the rents of the land of this country just by creating credit and dealing in money. So the critique of the money system is absolutely correct, but if we focus on the money issue, if we told the banks you're going to stop this, we're not going to allow you to get away with the racket that you've been running, automatically that would not solve our problems, because what would happen is that the profits that are being creamed off by the bankers at the present time would be creamed off by the landowners. Think of the land market, property market, but no, think land market, not property, because if you think property, you begin to think of bricks and mortar. The land market is like a sponge. It soaks up the surplus. Now, it can't soak up the wages, because you've got to have people producing goods that, and a value that ends up in rent. It can't soak up the profits of capital, because we know that if we're going to have value-adding enterprises, there's got to be a profit going to the capital owners. Everything over and above that is soaked up by the land market, unless there are groups that are powerful enough to take a share. So if trade unions get together and are able to exercise some power to demand wages over and above the competitive level, then that's got to come from somewhere, that extra that they're creaming off. It actually comes out of the rent of land. If the bankers are able to cream off some extraordinary profits, it actually comes out of the rent of land. The reason for stressing that is this. If you reverse this, if you say to the trade unions, right, you know, my name's Thatcher and you're not going to now exercise the power to claim extraordinary wages, what happens to the money that the trade unions are taking in the form of that extra layer that they got through extraordinary power? It doesn't go into capital, it ends up in higher property prices, because the property owner says, well, guys, it seems that you can afford to pay more. There's more. You're not claiming it as wages. That money is not going to be left floating around. Oh, my house price has gone up. It's actually the land under the house that's gone up in value, the location. So if the banking system was defused, which it needs to be, I agree, unless it was done simultaneously with this one reform, so that all the rents were channeled into the public purse, then the landowners like me would say, oh great, the bonuses are not going into the City of London, up go house prices, you see? So I and my fellow landowners would capture that value. And the only way to stop me capturing it is if I'm aware that if I do capture it, it's going to go to the government anyway. We need an equilibrium, we need a balance. So the land market is an effective way of collating the surplus, but it becomes destructive if that surplus goes into my pockets rather than the community's pockets. Because if it goes into my pockets, then, well, the government's going to have to tax you for going to work. And so we get this pathological situation of utter destruction. So we need a comprehensive reform that includes the banking system, but it has to be done in a balanced way, and it has to, in my view, it has to start with recognising that the rents of land and natural resources, which represent the value of our culture as well as natural resources, our culture is expressed, the value of it is expressed through what we're willing to pay for a location. When I say, look, I want to live in Richmond, it's not because nature's lovely in Richmond, because actually I'm a long way from nature. I want access to community services, the public transport, school, hospital, and that the net value of those services is captured in through the land market. I say I'm willing to pay this amount to live in this location. Well, so although we call it land value, it's actually society's value. And one of the bad terminologies that we've been using for 100 years is this notion of a land value tax. And so the people like me have been directing people to think in terms of land and nature only, instead of the services of nature, yes, but also the services of our community, which are converge in this one location value. Yes, sir.
I was wondering what percentage of the land profits you would see as a reasonable taxable amount,
well,
pro rata.
Yeah. Well, people like me have misrepresented the kind of reform that we've needed for the last 100 years, because we've talked in terms of taxing the land value, and a tax is always what? 5%, 10%, 50%, 75%, but it's never the whole of the sum. And I now realise it was a bad move psychologically by people like me for the last four generations advocating a land value based tax. Because if you talk in terms of a land value based tax, first of all, you're acknowledging the legitimacy of the ownership of land value, and then you're saying that we'll only take part of that revenue instead of the whole of it. So, from my point of view, as of very recently, I don't want to tax the rent of land at all. What I want is for people to pay for the services they receive. So when I go into Tesco, Mr. Tesco doesn't say, well, we'd like you to pay 5% or 10% or 75% of the cost of the goods you're going to wheel away in your trolley. He says, look, this is what it costs. You've got to pay the full cost of it. If I want public services, I should pay the full cost in the form of the rents that those services equate to. That's the whole of the rent, not part of the rent. But then, and at the same time, I do not want to be taxed on my earned incomes. So the answer is 100%, or full cost pricing is the way I now express it. So, you know, like the estate agent, when you go along, he says, well, if you want to buy this house, you know, it's got a good school nearby and there's a park for your kiddies to run around in. And so this house costs X £100,000. Well, so most of that is the value of those services. Well, why aren't I paying all of that value, which doesn't include the value of the house because somebody built that and provided it, but all the value that, that the estate agent says represents all those public services, why aren't I paying that to the people who are providing the services? Why am I paying the homeowner the value of the existence of the park and the hospital and the school and the railway? We live in an insane system where in our private life we don't expect to walk away with a basket of goods having only paid 50% or 25% of the value to the owner, but in the public sector we expect to only pay a proportion of the value, and then the rest comes from, well, let's have a tax on this, that and the other. And that is an utterly destructive way of trying to balance the books. And they're not doing it. We can see that we build up the national and personal debts to the point where we're now sacrificing public services because it's acknowledged that we just can't keep funding by borrowing more and more and more.
Mm. So the farmer would actually be paying rent for the land that he uses for his farm?
The farmer would be paying, well, tenant farmers already do. Mm. Tenant farmers pay rent for the use of the land, but they happen to pay it to a landowner rather than to the people who provide services that the farmer wants in his locality. So tenants, whether on as farmers or as people who occupy apartments, are already paying the full rent for the services they receive. And when I buy a house, I'm actually already paying the full cost because the estate agent tells me, if you want this house, it'll cost, well, look at what happened to Martin Wolf. He says when he bought his house in 1984, the capitalized value of the rental stream in the locality where he was going to live, when you capitalize that rent, it was £100,000. So he paid the full value of those services at that point in time, but he stopped doing so thereafter. So he was paying back a mortgage based on the value in 1984, but jumped to 2010 and his house is worth more than £1 million. He is being subsidized by the people whose wages are being taxed. And I describe that in detail in a book called Ricardo's Law, where I can show that it's the tenants who are subsidizing the freehold owners of property, and the people who walk away with the biggest gains are the people with the highest value properties in Knightsbridge and Chelsea. And I show with the numbers that the richest people in our society stop paying taxes after 2 or 3 years. And how does that happen? Because we're told, look, if you're rich, you pay over your working lifetime, you pay 5 times more than the lowest income people. So how is it that that the rich are being subsidized by the poor people? The people with the highest value properties recover the whole of a lifetime's tax payments in 2 or 3 years of rising house prices. So if your house is worth £2 million, within a couple of years, a 10% increase in the value of your property, all of your lifetime's taxes on your earnings that you've recovered through the capital gains on your plot of land. So you're laughing. And well, then who is subsidising your services? The silly buggers who are tenants. The people up north who struggle to pay, they're at the margins of our economy, they struggle to pay their taxes. Many of them are tenants. And they are actually subsidising the rich guys in the southeast, and yet we buy this myth from the politicians in London that it's the southeast subsidising the rest of the country. The reverse is the truth when you look at the property market.
I'm just thinking about the end of the nation state and how globalism now is kind of like a new paradigm, global capitalism, and what have you.
Yeah.
So how the world has become, in terms of a global village, that's the kind of terminology or whatever, and it's multicultural, pluralistic. So I'm just wondering how, because it's underpinned by a war of ideas and ideologies. So I'm just trying to, I suppose it's a bit of a rhetorical question, envisaging this hypothetical scenario, this whatever you want to call it. I'm not going to call it a utopian vision. I don't want to put words in your mouth. But so how is it going to play out in a multicultural pluralistic society where you have a melting pot of worldviews that has created conflict because of the wars and the fragmentation that has happened in Europe? I'm just trying to relate what you've said to you know, contemporary global multicultural pluralistic paradigm, you know, culture.
Well, so we have a world of people of many colours and many faiths, but it's actually one economic ideology. They all basically agree that about the pricing mechanism. We can see this in the discussions on the environment. Logically, a lot of the countries from Latin America and South America ought to be arguing in favour of a pricing approach to solving our environmental problems. But no, that isn't happening. They are coming along the same route as the predators in Europe and North America. Instead of us saying the way to conserve scarce natural resources is to charge people for the consumption of them, what we're doing is creating new markets to make money out of the emissions of CO2, so that the banks in the City of London are now hoarding, or have been hoarding for the last couple of years, these permits that have been issued free to the polluters, because they know their value is going up and they are creating markets to trade in pollution permits. Instead of saying, if you're a polluter, you will pay to compensate the community. If you don't want to pay, then just reduce the pollution, reduce your emissions. No, in this country we're talking about giving incentives, money to people to reduce their pollution. It's the obverse of what we should be doing. And it's this rationale that is shared just about basically everybody in the world. So there is a homogeneity about economics. And one of the problems with Sharia law and Islam is that the issue of land and rent is a void. They sell Sharia law as ethical economics because they have an attitude that goes back to biblical times about interest. Okay, I'm not arguing against that, but they are totally silent about rent and land. In fact, their banks conspire with people to enter into property deals, which are no different to what we do in the West, but they spin it as if it's somehow ethical economics. So one stream of the monotheistic religions, which ought to be helping us to understand that we need an ethical economics, is not able to do so because it's blind on the one issue of land and rent. It's all for dealing with the money thing and interest. Yeah, but look at the scale of poverty in the Middle East. Why? Well, because they just haven't got their heads around this one issue. So, unfortunately, although it's a multicultural world and multicultural nations like America and ours, it's homogenous in its outlook. And that's the success of the colonial policy of Europe over the last 500 years. We have created societies in our own image all over the world. And where we haven't, as in China, they've just not twigged on that the one thing that they really need is not Marx and capital and wicked landlords, but just the land issue. They're allowing their people to get away with murder in China. They're doing what we do here, just as viciously. So I'm afraid that there is no hope just in looking at it in terms of the multicultural societies, because the diversity of ideas that you refer to, I'm afraid, I don't believe is there, not when it comes to this one issue. And so, you know, that's why it's frustrating for people like me to get a discussion going. All I want is a discussion. If you don't want to make the change, fine, but let's at least rationally debate this. But no, you can't get a discussion going.
So you've got to change the autonomy of economics, because it's autonomous.
We've got to help people to re-understand the full classical economic model. We've just got to restore the understanding about land and rent in the economy, and that's all it is. And once you do that, suddenly things become so blindingly obvious.
Yes. I was just going to say, there's a lot of knowledge here which I can follow it, but I'm trying to distill it into an understanding to take away with me. And it seems like you're saying that, to break it down into very simple crude terms, power serves power, and it doesn't serve the lack thereof. Yeah. And so you've got the people in power maintaining their power, and that's never going to change unless there is a reinterpretation of value and of what real power is, which is what we provide for each other through our skills and through just real value, not symbolic.
That's right.
So turning to that understanding of our own sense of power and authority and our own sense of value that we have to share with each other, surely that in itself is subverting this whole...
But it will only subvert if you're able to put a name to the thing that is at the source of the problem. Because if you don't do that, then the people in power are happy to say to you, look, see, we're a free society. It's a democratic, we're transparent, you can say all these wonderful things, you can criticise. But nothing will change until you say, now hang on, guys, it really does boil down to this rent, doesn't it? And then Mr. Cameron will say, hang on, my wife is the daughter of a major landowner. And then you start to see where the ramifications go. As soon as you raise, look, just think about it. The one most sensitive issue for the tabloid middle market newspapers is houses. The phrase is hard-working middle class homeowner. That is off limits. You can't touch them. Why? What is it about the hard-working middle-class homeowner? Not landowner, homeowner. He worked hard to create his house, you know. Hang on, he bought it for 100,000 and he could sell it for 1,000,000. But he says he didn't add any value to it. You can't add value to a plot of land. How come he can sell it for £1,000,000 now? Where did that extra 900,000 come from? Martin Wolf is being absolutely honest. He's saying it's wrong, and we should be using that revenue to fund public services. But he doesn't get a hearing any more than I do, and he's writing in the Financial Times. You have to actually, you know, name the name. You have to be able to say, I know the source of this problem.
That's to bring about the external change in policy.
Yes.
But I think there's also an internal attitude that goes with that, which complements that and allows that to happen. And I think that's often missed out in economic.
It's imperative that the individual begins to understand what you're saying, because without that, there is no way. You know, idiots like me have spent 40 years thinking that all we have to do is go to the politician, explain this optimum public finance system, and they're going to do it. And so one day I tweet, but regularly I used to go home to my wife and say, you know, I spent half an hour with this member of parliament. It's as if I'm not speaking his language, as if I'm speaking some rare African dialect. He didn't understand what I was saying, and he almost certainly didn't, because I used words like land and rent, and he would say, hang on, what do you mean land? Oh, you mean farmland? No, that's only a small part of the value. What do you mean rent? So I've spent an hour trying to give him basic economics, and then the time's up. Well, this sounds very interesting, Mr. Harrison. If you show me the votes, if there is a constituency for this policy, it sounds good to me, I'll do it. I'm not the politician, you're a politician, but you're not going to sell it. And so nothing happens, and so you're right. We have to find a way for people to come to a new understanding of what, how they define their freedom, their personal position, because without that, it ain't going to happen, because the people who we entrust with the power to make the decisions are not going to do it. And we have history demonstrated time and again. They would rather disasters happen and their own heads get chopped off, that's the history, than actually say, yes, this is in the public interest. This is what we need to do. It's good for everybody. Nobody loses. No, they will not do it because their egos get in the way. They want big, grand country mansions, which are funded, you know. When next time you go to one of these country homes and you look at the splendours of these big mansions, think about all the hamlets in the area that were sucked dry of the rents in order to congeal that, all that energy, the creative energy from all those people into this one country mansion that one small family can live in with their lovely works of art, you know, celebrating their ancestors. That is the character of our society. We impoverish our communities in order to inflate the egos, the narcissism of those landowning families. And on a smaller scale, the middle class, hard-working homeowner is doing the same thing today. And until the individual, enough individuals, come to terms with the sort of thing you're saying, we need examining their identities, recovering the realization that we don't have an authentic culture, that what we have is inherited from a pathologically disturbed class of people from the past, passed down to us, and we're living the vicarious, empty lives that they bequeathed to us. Until we understand all this, it ain't going to happen.
The thing is, I mean, it's not going to happen, is it?
if we sitting in this room actually get this, and then don't do anything about talking to each other about it and networking, it's, it isn't
that. That's right. Mm-hmm. We've hit 5 o'clock, Wayne. Should we call it quits?
Yeah, thank you so much, Craig.
Yeah,
absolutely. Fantastic.
Where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.